Hi everyone, and welcome to the new episode of the On Design podcast. I'm your host, Justina Green. How are you doing? What's new? How's this last part of the year treating you? And are you a person who really looks forward to Christmas and the break? Do you get a break at Christmas? Or is it just not really on your mind and you just keep working and kind of keep doing kind of what's ahead of you? I personally cannot wait until Christmas, because for me, that's the only time that I get a real break from work during the year. And that's probably my really bad management of my time off. But I don't know, being a freelancer, it feels like Christmas is the only time when everybody just chills for a moment, even if it's kind of 9 days. I really, really look forward to it. But I know that weeks leading up to it can be really intense. So I hope everybody's managing work okay, finishing off projects, or already planning for the new year, because kind of this time of the year can also be a very nice space to start reflecting on the year, kind of plan for the year ahead and reassess. Because remember as well, we need to take breaks, we need to rest, and we need to have that time to reassess where we're going and what we're doing, to actually check if everything that we're doing still serves us. So I do encourage you, even if it's 2 hours in the afternoon or it's an hour at the weekend, it doesn't have to be long, but to just have some time to reassess where you're heading and to cheer on yourself for all the good things that you've done and to see what you're taking with you into the new year and what you can maybe leave behind. And I'll do the same, and then we can compare notes. But before this year ends, I wanted to let you know about The Conran Shop, who are supporting this show. The Conran Shop is one of the world's leading design retailers, with stores in London, Paris, Japan and South Korea. Founded by Sir Terence Conran in 1973, the brand offers an eclectic, hand-selected edit of furniture, lighting and home accessories at all price points. They all champion Sir Terence's philosophy of plain, simple, useful objects for everyday living. From Eames Icons by Vitra to future classics by up-and-coming talents, the Conran Shop hosts some of the biggest names in the industry and consistently champions new makers too. Visit conranshop.com today and follow at the Conran Shop official on Instagram to immerse yourself in the world of design. And back to today's episode, our guest is Andreas Reisinger, who's a digital artist, and you might know him best for his Magnolia chair, which was a digital design, then translated into a physical product by Moy, or for Winterhouse, he designed also digitally. Our conversation, though, is one of those chats that didn't follow what I might have thought it will be, and I mean it in the most positive way. We actually start our conversation by discovering that Andreas's first love was music, and we discover his approach to creative work, focus on discipline and practice. We then dive into his visual work. We talk about taking risks and breaking daily routines to create something new, but also to encourage new thoughts and perceptions of the world around us. Let's dive in. Perfect. Well, thank you so much for making time to chat to me. I've been aware of your work like for a while, but we never actually properly talked. So I'm super curious about, you know, I'm really curious because that's what happens when you speak to someone, you know, because I've read about you online and about your work, but you already, just before we started to record, you told me there are things that you're more interested than others kind of to talk about. So I'm super interested to dive into, to find out more about you and more than we can just read online. But we'll start with a quick warm up with quick fire questions. So I'll ask you just 5 questions, if you can give me short answers, so that our listeners can get a glimpse into your brain, into your mind as well. So if you weren't in your current role, what would you be doing?
I feel very attracted to composition, like music or something related to theater plays. Or in other interviews, I think I said something like a scientist, and that's true. But I think that's something I already have, like, in my veins. So I don't want to boost it too much because it will go crazy. So I think it's better to say that music and something more performative.
And what would your dream project be?
That's a tough one. This is the warm up, right? I don't know if it's a, if it's a dream project, but I feel really good when I inspire people, when people write me and say that my work is giving them strength to keep on working on their careers.
And what's one thing you can't stand in design?
I don't like when people is so constrained on systems. I believe that's kind of boring.
And the final question from the quick five. What's the best piece of advice you were ever given?
One of my professors at very early professors of music and composition was, if you don't like it, nobody will.
That's a good one. We talked about the questions I've had for you, but I think there are some really nice ideas coming up from the quick fire, so I'm going to dive straight into this. You talked about constrained systems, identities. We have music, and then we have the graphic arts. So can you tell me, how does your brain function? Or how do you... how do you see the world, and kind of from kind of early on, what was your approach to the art or creativity?
I believe I see the world quite deformed, and I usually have in different situations, I usually have more courage to do some risky things than other people would thought. That it's very risky and crazy, and I don't feel like that. I don't know why, and maybe it's because I really believe in what I'm doing, till the point that if it doesn't work, I will be happy to try it, and I can't imagine another kind of life where I'm not having risks and trying to make it work as I want and as I imagine to do it. From an early age, I was much more like close to arts and to crafts than any other discipline. Even if my parents are a biologist and a chemist, as far as I know, from two generations, I'm the only one that was like more around crafts and art. And I don't know why, but I felt always very connected with ways of expression. And I started with more like acoustic, like audio. I felt very connected with music, and with then I dive into composition and more like complicated stuff, more like a theory of music, which makes a lot more sense being in like having been living for a lot of years with my parents. But I think I always grow out of limitations, and that's usually what push me to create things, even when I feel that the limitations are struggling and are like cutting my imagination. When I was 10 years old, something like that, I wanted to start playing electric guitar. And my parents told me, okay, look, we can't afford an electric guitar, and we can't afford a professor of electric guitar. But here in the neighborhood, there is a conservatory of classical music that they teach music. And it's free, kind of. If you like, we can go and visit And I was very young, so I said yes, and I started studying that for a long time. And I think there I completely learned discipline, a lot more of things, but mainly discipline, because I remember passing hours and hours practicing in front of the metronome, like polishing my nails in the best way possible to have the best angle to for the strings, and everything was so, had to be so perfect. But because I was studying classical guitar, unfortunately, we had to, I had a professor that told me a piano is a guitar well made. So in classical guitar, we have to avoid any kind of error from touching the strings that in the piano are already solved because are under that door in the box. So it's quite interesting the amount of hours that you have to spend on it to polish your sound and the movement of your fingers in order not to create this like sound on the strings, which sometimes is it's quite nice, but when you are trying to interpret like Tárrega or Bach or something like that, sounds pretty awful. I think all of that years and practice gave me a lot of discipline, and that discipline made me practice a lot, and practicing more made me better at doing it, made me more confident, and more confidence and doing it better made my professors like said that I was doing very good, and that was very good for my confidence and for my, let's say, like good ego. So I continue to do that for forever, for a long time. And that's when I actually clicked something in my mind and understood that whatever I do, if I spend a lot of hours and with passion, and I practice a lot, I will be good at it. It was not actually so conscious at that age, but I already had the habits. You know, it's like I want to practice more because if I practice more, like in the next month, I can play this other song, let's say, which is quite difficult. And I think that was a very good school, like actually more than the school, which I learned basic things that I can't apply to everyday life as everyone. And another interesting point was that at that Conservatory of Music was kind of a university for a lot of people, because people were like graduated from school and they started the conservatory as a career at the age of 18, 20, something like that. And I was very young. So I was like circling around like people that was more mature than me, and they were really spending a lot of time practicing. So that was interesting about the context, because a lot of my friends at school were just fooling around and smoking on the corners of the school, and it's nice, it's fun, but I was not, hopefully I was not attracted to that, and I wanted to play better. So and it was not out of it was not because of my parents saying to me like you should not do that or whatever. It was like really out of a passion, like I didn't want to spend the time doing anything else, which that was pretty natural and felt very organic. But then after a lot of years, I lost a lot that kind of passion. It was almost 10 years of studying music, and I started to stumble up on myself, like spending more hours designing like covers of the songs that I was composing or the little albums than in composition, like in music composition. So I decided to start in the design university. And that's when I think everything kind of rolled very quickly, because I already had discipline and I understood and I learned a lot of tools from like design tools, you know, it's like multiply and reduce and maximize and scale it and invert it and like design tools and design thinking, which it's actually pretty basic. I mean, anyone can learn to design in 1 year or at least these resources, these tools. Then you have to apply it a lot of times until you get better. But as soon as I understood those tools, I understood that that I had a lot of freedom that I didn't have in music, because in classical music is very constrained, and you have to play. You can interpret things, but at that age, I was not too radical on interpretation. And in design was like jumping on an empty void of I can do whatever I want and I can mix different worlds that nobody has done that before and call it a design. So it was pretty amazing.
And is that when you started to take risks?
Yeah, I think that was when my mind started to apply those design, let's say, resources and tools to the everyday life. It was my life changed. I always say that the design school, like the university, haven't taught me a lot about design, but changed my life, because if you think about it, like all of those design resources are crucial for organizing your life, for decision making, for structuring and trying to make your better decisions for your future, for the present, and to create relationships, and how you create relationships, how you manage timing inside your life with other people, the way you open a book, for example, and you open a book and you find the first page or the three first pages are like completely empty, and then you in the fourth page you see the name of the book, and then you find like a little text that is like a text for the daughter of the writer, and then so it's a way of it's very abstract, but it feels like that very specific way of teaching how to design a book, it's much more applicable to life than a book. And I always thought about going to an entrance of a space, for example. I want to feel like I'm opening a book, or if I open a magazine and the first page is like very loud with an advertising. It's like the way these design resources are spread out through different mediums, I think it's what interesting me more than the actual result.
So do you see design everywhere?
Yeah, design is almost in, I mean, design are, for me, it's like the way to organize stuff throughout time and space. Depending on how deep you organize, you are a better designer or you are a not so good designer. And I think art is something in the outside of it that I have been circling around since many years. That I always told the people I work with, and I usually do, that I'm terrible designing. And I think that's art. Like bad design, like but with intention, like unfinished design is quite close to art.
Because you see yourself, do you see yourself more as a digital artist? Oh, do you see yourself as a digital artist or just artist?
Yeah, I think digital is a medium. It's usually helpful to when I present myself to someone that has no idea what I do, and it's better to trigger some conversations around technology, and it's usually easier to end up explaining my work if I start saying that I'm a digital artist. But actually, it's the same that saying a painter. Like, it's like a painter is an artist. So it's just a way of, it's a subcategory of subcategorizing yourself and tagging yourself just in one thing. For me, the most interesting painters ever have been exploring with different mediums and mostly called artists, not just painter.
The Conrad Shop is here to satisfy all your Christmas gifting needs as we enter the most wonderful time of the year. From design-led presents for the whole family to eye-catching decorations for your home, there is something for everyone at the home of iconic designs and future classics, even pampered pets. Head in store and online to find the next festive favorite. Visit conradshop.com today.
So tell me about, and kind of for our listeners who will be aware of your work, I'd love to hear in your own words what your work is and what do you want to achieve with it or what drives you?
I have been quite interested in using my work as a tool for driving attention to the conscious. From visual and also exploring from different mediums like sound, installations, and like scents, like the exhibition I did in last year in Miami, which was a trigger to start working with more and more with more senses, which I think is something not only interesting for me, but it brings people into the present. And I think that's huge. I mean, if art or design can make people that are caught into daily routines, some are terrible, endless daily routines that are almost all of the things that they do are automatic. And they are caught in this texture of, like, procedural texture of things that the things that just play, like, automatically. And design and art can break that, create like a kind of a little triangle that goes in a little breakage of something, and you can actually open a whole new world to people just for looking at an art piece or using or being involved in a design experience. And that brought them into the present, and that brought them into what they feel and what they think about it. I think that's quite something.
And how do you create those experiences? How do you, what's your design process essentially? Do you have the idea of how you want to affect people at the end and what you want to make them feel? Or does it start in a more intuitive way? And then the outcome can surprise you.
Yeah. Yeah. Usually it's an intuitive start. Most of the pieces that I like the most were very intuitive, and the result was surprising me also. And I can't just like digitize like what people should feel or think when they see my work. I'm just doing it in order to trigger something on them. But I can't control that.
And have you had surprising reactions where the feedback you get would surprise you, how people read the piece or how it made them feel?
Yeah, always. That's a big part and a beautiful part of sharing your work with people. That's very important. It's beautiful. It's very different than just creating something for yourself and like storing or saving that thing into your computer or in your basement. It's like totally different.
And can you tell me about one of those projects that is really close to your heart that maybe you felt was pivotal in your career and how you saw yourself and your work?
A lot of them have helped me with different, helped me understood myself from different perspectives. I usually create to understand myself. And the more I create, the more I understand myself. But if I had to choose one, the most recent one that made me think a lot after I created it was The Smell of Pink, the exhibition I did in Miami last year. That was quite interesting because it was a smell. It was a scent that was tied to a color. And the experience, the physical experience was just that. But people are still remembering, people are still remembering the smell, like that scent. And they are linking that scent with the fun and the feeling of exploring that they had last year in sunny Miami, exploring Basel with their family or their friends, that's quite amazing.
And how did you create the scent? And what did it make you feel, the design process of that installation?
The exhibition was curated by Jimena Caminos. She's one of my, if I have to use the words of Jodorowsky, she's one of my malas y maestras al mismo tiempo, at the same time. And we work with an alchemist that is called Alexis. And it was a very intuitive process. She works most like something very similar like I do. She start mixing things and she feel it. When it works, it works. And that's it. There's no rules or drops off or quantity, or it's more like a you are in the process of doing it and you are experiencing that. I know, and the result is how you have been doing it, and not just a recipe. So that's totally different than trying to have like 10 drops of this and 5 drops of that, which can make something industrial, but at the same time, the oils are always different. The vibrations and the frequencies that you are at that moment are super different. The vessels where you are storing the oils are changing the material. So it's all very performatic and very unique. And I think it feels very nice to work like that.
So that's very different from that classical guitar training, isn't it?
Yeah, but at the same time, I can relate in the feeling of like, if I can go back in my mind to the memory when I'm performing or interpreting a specific piece, and I think there's something there. Even when you are playing something that somebody else wrote or composed, there's something in the interpretation, in how you are vibrating with the instrument and how you apply this strength, this energy to move these strings that also vibrates and vibrates in your body. And there's something there that it's quite similar.
So there's more similarities than I would have thought there are.
Yeah. Yeah, maybe not in composition or when you are doing theory.
And I have a question, talking about digital art, because I know that many, whether there are articles online or interviews, you're very often portrayed as a digital artist, an artist that creates collectibles, that works in kind of with Web3 and NFTs. But from our conversation so far, none of it seems to be the part in the core of you. And I know that we started the discussion about mixing different worlds, breaking systems, and also not having that identity built just on one thing and holding on to that. So how do you see yourself grow? Or how do you break those systems to not be pigeonholed as the Web3 artist or the digital artist? Because I think that's a really easy shortcut for people to make with your work.
Yeah, yeah. It's not a bad thing. It usually helps people to, tax help people to understand and to position you in a context where it's easier for them to learn about your career, and that's always a good thing. But I always tried from the beginning in my when I started investigating and exploring and playing with Web3, I always tried to avoid and to educate the people around me to not call me or not call NFT art or crypto art. Mm-hmm. And I think now there's a more mainstream education about it. But at the first 6 months, 1 year, everyone was a crypto artist. And what is that? Like, it's very vague. And I didn't feel like, I don't feel like crypto artist is a way of categorizing. Maybe I can find like two or three people that can be called crypto artists, then the other mass, they are not, or they are painters or illustrators or designers or other things. But crypto artists is very, very, very tiny tag that applies only to very few. Anyway, I think when I first started working with and exploring Web3, I was super excited because I felt like there was a whole new set of rules that made Web3 and made the NFT particularly a new medium. Not just as a certificate of authenticity like a paper can do, but a medium itself, like a whole medium, like a McLuhan medium. Like, and if you think about that, if you think about NFTs in that way, you understand that NFT is not the artwork. NFT is the medium that is providing the career for that artwork. So that's when I started working on my project Polynation, which basically is a way of interacting with the artwork. The artwork is being alive throughout 1 year, and it's not using the blockchain and using the NFT technology to tokenize and create a certification of something created offline, but actually a complete system of exchange. So basically the project is based on the collectors have a pollen and one of my pieces, and with the pollen 4 times a year during the seasons they can pollinate my artwork. The result of that pollination creates a new unseen piece that can be more unique or more common, depending on a different set of rules, let's say, that it's all inspired by nature. I haven't created anything. Like, it's just, for example, it's easier to pollinate in summer or spring than in winter. So in winter, it's easier to pollinate, and as an outcome of that pollination, the collector will receive a more unique piece, because not all pollinations will succeed. So it's very, it's kind of like copy how nature works and applying that on a blockchain level. And I have been playing around with that concept and creating all that like transpolation of rules for a while. And I thought I had like a very solid construction. And in the first season, in the pollination of the first season, I stumbled upon a technological error just before the first pollination, and all of the collectors were online and were waiting for participate. And for 6 hours, we had like a down the server, and everyone were like gone to sleep and going to with her family and whatever. I was so mad. I can't believe that technology can provide you and also can break all of your plans just when Wi-Fi doesn't work. But then I I understood that in that weakness, a technological system that has weakness is more biological. So it makes a technological system more biological with flaws. And I think that's the more nature-like ever. So from that on, I added one of the rules that it's the errors and flaws in the system, of course, are part of this project, and we have to embrace them.
And so when the system has gone down, did all the collectors manage to pollinate? And did they manage to get the new pieces? Or did that not happen?
Yeah. But after the 6 hours, we had to push another 6 hours, the deadline. So people had time to enter again. Yeah.
Yeah. But it's really interesting. Like you say, so the whole ecosystem digitally, that's the tool, and your work is part. It, like you say, it doesn't quite exist like a JPEG on a blockchain. It exists and lives in that ever-changing system. That's more akin to nature, like you say, with the problems occurring or servers going down.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah, of course it's not good when you are transferring money. But I think it's interesting. We are like that. And we value flaws and errors and weakness. And I think we are more and more trying to, as a humanity, as a civilization, we are trying to embrace those weakness as a part of our strength. And I think that's what will trigger a beautiful, big change in the near future.
The embracing of the mistakes, of the failures?
Mistakes, failures, and weakness. Because weakness is not failure. Weakness is something else. We put that name because we know what is strong. But why a weakness can't be as strong as something strong? Just because we tag it.
So to slowly wrap up our conversation, we started to talk about the weakness and failure and how that's not the same thing, and working with technology and embracing the change. And I know that many designers, and it goes back to the systems and kind of, you know, what you said right at the beginning, that you know, they have certain type of a line, certain type of a typography, and they don't go outside of the known or what's associated with a certain identity. And I was wondering, what would your piece of advice be, kind of to finish off our chat, for those designers and creatives who feel constrained but don't know how to get out of whatever they're creating, you know, where they creating, they don't love it anymore, they don't feel passionate about it, but they don't know how to pivot.
I think there's no specific gold solution or something like that, but there is a routine, there is a ritual, and if you can create an habit of understanding that you will create things that you will don't like, but you will still gonna create more things, and you're gonna to not like them for a long period of time. After a huge period of time, you will start to understand that all that things were very necessary. You have to take out a lot of ugliness, let's say, until you find beauty. So if you don't do that ugly things, you are just delaying the appearance of beauty, because it's something that that takes time. And it takes time of you doing things and applying time, like spending time. So it takes time for you spending time. It's like you have to do it. and don't criticize. Of course, you have to learn about what you have done, or if you prefer to explore any other things. But if you don't like what you are doing and you have spent like 10 hours, it's like, okay, that's why you don't like it.
Because you've only spent 10 hours.
Yeah.
And then, so that's kind of a full circle, takes us back to the discipline and the practice, what you said at the beginning.
Yeah, discipline is very important. It's not everything. Of course, talent and sensibility are very different things and can come from different sources in your life, in everyone. But I'm sure whatever is your talent or your sensibility, if you apply several amount of hours with discipline, you will create amazing things.
And that's the perfect note to finish our conversation on. And for our listeners to now think about what they're doing and how they're applying yourself. Because I even know from like my own stuff, like my own work, I get impatient. And the most progress I've ever had was only by when I would apply myself every day. So I would draw every day. And then I sit and think about it, and I do nothing about it, but I sit and think about it. And then I'm coming to that point now where I'm thinking, okay, now I need to practice every day again, because I've done too much thinking and nothing has changed from thinking. I need to now start to do things.
Yeah. You just kept in your thinking.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Thank you so much, Andreas. Thank you so much for your time and your knowledge and sharing the process. And we look forward to seeing your work. Thank you.
Thank you for having me. It was a really interesting conversation. It's not so easy to find.
Such a brilliant chat with Andreas. I hope it's left you feeling nourished. I really love his approach that's focused on discipline and practice, and knowing that if you apply yourself, you can really be the best, or at least the best version of yourself. This belief runs contrary to some of other beliefs that focus on talent and luck and are much less empowering, actually. So if you've been telling yourself that you can't do something because others are better than you or you don't have talent, then it might be worth reassessing your situation and actually looking at what you can do with the time and skills you already have at hand. I sometimes fall into the limited thinking too, so I'll do that exercise with you to really accelerate my work in the new year. And then, we can compare notes again. And that's all for today. If you've enjoyed our conversation, then the best way to support this podcast is to rate and review it on Apple Podcasts or share it on Instagram and WhatsApp with your friends so that we can have more people joining our community. And that's all for today. I'll see you here next week.